From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, The Celluloid Closet, we talk with the directors of a new documentary examining how gays and lesbians have been portrayed in movies over the century. The Celluloid Closet is based on a groundbreaking book by Vito Russo, who died of AIDS in 1991. We'll listen back to a 1985 interview with Russo. Then the story of a movie that was never under consideration for an Academy Award, a cheap exploitation film from 1965 that may be on its way to becoming a cult film. Who Killed Teddy Bear, starring Sal Mineo as a voyeur and phone pervert, has just been re-released. We'll talk with the director, Joseph Cates. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Anthony Davis's reissued 1981 album, Episteme. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this Academy Awards Day, our subject is a new documentary that examines how homosexuals have been portrayed in movies over the century. How have they been portrayed? Well, the short answer is, for nearly 30 years, the Hollywood Production Code forbade the portrayal of gay characters and prohibited any mention of homosexuality on screen. And when the code was lifted, if a character was gay, you could bet that character was going to suffer.
Don't you see? I can't stand to have you touch me. I can't stand to have you look at me. Oh, it's all my fault. I ruined your life and I ruined my own. I swear I didn't know it. I didn't mean it. Oh, I feel so damn sick and dirty. I can't stand it anymore.
That's Shirley MacLaine in a scene from The Children's Hour, just one of the films under consideration in the new documentary The Celluloid Closet. We'll meet the directors in a few minutes. The Celluloid Closet is adapted from the groundbreaking book of the same name, first published in 1981. The author, Vito Russo, died of AIDS in 1991. I spoke with Vito Russo in 1985, and he told me why he thought it was so devastating for lesbians and gays to see how they were portrayed in movies.
We go to the movies to see ourselves, to see a reflection of our lives. And in fact, motion pictures in this country have been a reflection of America, of the way we see our country and our people. And so when you go to the movies and you don't find yourself up there, it comes home to you in a double sense that you are an alien in your own culture.
Well, you say in your book that screenwriters and directors would talk to you, but you really couldn't find any actors who would talk about the subject.
That's right. Even heterosexual actors would talk about playing homosexual characters because they don't feel threatened. Gay actors, who very seldom play gay characters anyway, just don't want to talk because it's too threatening to their own personal identity to have to get a little closer to the subject than they want to. They don't want to discuss it. You know, and I understand that. I also understand the reasons why gay actors are in the closet in Hollywood. I mean, it's very dangerous to come out of the closet in any profession, but even more so in Hollywood, because Hollywood creates an illusion, a fantasy that people have to live up to. I mean, a lot has changed in the last 20 years. You know, we've now been able to discuss a subject which 20 years ago you couldn't even talk about on radio or television. And yet it is still true that economically it's dangerous. Hollywood is a freelance town where every six or eight weeks or 2 or 3 months or whatever it is, an actor is looking for a new job. So it's not like if you're a banker, what do you change jobs once in your life, twice? An actor changes jobs every 6 months. And if 10%, 15% of the people who do the hiring in that town don't like gays, you're cutting yourself out of that much of the job market.
Now, there was a period in the movies of close to 30 years where you couldn't portray homosexuality at all. The code lasted from 34 to 61. What specifically did it say on that subject?
Essentially, it was only one line. It said, sexual perversion or any inference of it is strictly forbidden. And so this was only one rule, which the Hays Code promoted, which included you could not show married people sleeping in a double bed. That's where we got single beds from. You could not show suicide. You could not show murder going unpunished. You could not use certain words. You could not show adultery, prostitution. I mean, there was a whole list of things you weren't allowed to do. And for that period of time, 30, 35 years, whatever it was, you couldn't even say the word homosexual on the screen or allow the public to know that such people existed because it was considered indelicate and against industry standards.
Well, you write in your book that since you really couldn't refer overtly to homosexuality, that what ended up instead was that the symbols of homosexuality were manipulated. What do you mean by that?
Well, by the symbols of homosexuality, essentially, I mean the roles that were assigned to men and women. Masculinity and femininity are subjective, and yet they were manipulated to indicate sexual deviation without actually saying so. So that, for instance, in 1949, you had this movie, Young Man with a Horn, which was the life story of a jazz musician, Bix Beiderbecke, and it was Kirk Douglas, Doris Day, and Lauren Bacall. Lauren Bacall clearly played a lesbian in this movie. But it was 1949, and you couldn't say so. And so all the sort of iconography, the ways in which she was presented, were very masculine. She was tough, sophisticated, independent, all the things that eventually Katharine Hepburn obviously was playing for years, but she always lost in the end and submitted to her husband or her boyfriend. But all those qualities which we are supposed to take as masculine qualities, courageousness and drive and ability, were given to women who were considered less than women, you know, and their femininity was taken away from them. In the same way, the opposite side of the coin was that you got all these sort of stereotypical sissies to make you laugh. In Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers movies, there was always the sort of effeminate butler or best friend. And it goes right through film history, right up to Victor Victoria with the incredible Robert Preston character. And these signs, you know, of less than masculine became symbols for homosexuality. You didn't have to make it sexual. You were just saying this is a gay character because of the way he or she behaves.
So do you think that actually lesbianism and homosexuality became more stereotyped? Because in order to indicate mm-hmm. that there was a gay or a lesbian, you had to make the woman into a man or the man yeah. into a woman, so to speak, in yeah. order to give that message in a really covert way.
Yeah, well, because there was no allowance for depth or concept or context. And so, I mean, for instance, if you ask producers today on television, why is it that every time you have a gay character, the character has to be flamboyant and effeminate or stereotypical? And they say, well, that's what's called easy identification for television. If we have a gay character and we don't make that character a stereotype, how is the audience going to know that that character is gay? Well, the answer is that you have to take a little bit more time and you have to establish it in other ways. But we live in a very quick age where the audience has to be able to identify who they're looking at immediately. And in the absence of color or ethnicity, what they need is a quick stereotype to say, boom, gay character, and then go on to the next thing. So they don't have the luxury of establishing characters dramatically, you know, and making, you see, my idea is no more movies about homosexuality. My idea is that there should be movies, and in those movies, occasionally some of the characters should be gay implicitly, and their homosexuality should have nothing to do with the story. They should just be there the way they are in life. Now, that's not done very often. I could think of one example in the David Bowie film, which was directed by Nicholas Roeg, The Man Who Fell to Earth. Incredible example, because Buck Henry in that film plays David Bowie's lawyer, and he happens to be gay. He's incidentally gay. And it has nothing to do with the rest of the film. It's just established that he has a boyfriend. And at one point during the shooting of the film, Nicholas Roeg, the director, was asked by Buck Henry, why am I playing a gay character? Why is this character homosexual? And Roeg said, why not? There are homosexuals. And it was just sort of the easy solution to the problem. They exist in life. Why not put them in the movies? But don't make that the subject of every movie.
You have at the end of your book a list of ways that people who, that gay characters were either killed or committed suicide at the end of the movies. I mean,
true.
Have that many gay characters in the movies taken their own lives?
Yeah, the vast majority. It was the standard ending for a homosexual in the movies.
Did this start in around 1962?
Yeah, yeah. Actually, it started at the turn of the century. I mean, one of the very first films ever to deal with homosexuality came out of Germany in 1919, and the gay person committed suicide at the end of that movie. And it's been that way ever since. I think it's part of the fact that movie makers were considering the audience. You have to make a moral judgment on these people. And also, it takes from life. I mean, you can't just ignore the truth and say, well, the movies distorted everything. The movies did not distort everything. There is a truth in every stereotype. And for many, many years, homosexuals killed themselves because society would not tolerate them. A person would discover that they were gay, and they would commit suicide. And I'm not saying that this happened in the thousands. There are obviously millions of happy, healthy gay people, you know, but this was a staple of American movies, that homosexual life ends in tragedy, something that we know is not true now. But for years, the gay person killed themselves at the end of the movie. It happened in 26 out of 28 major films in 20 years, which dealt with homosexual characters.
Can you name three of them?
Oh, sure. I could. Well, The Children's Hour. At the end of The Children's Hour, Shirley MacLaine hangs herself. At the end of Advising Consent, Don Murray slits his throat. At the end of Justine, Cliff Gorman gets killed by having a hat pin stuck through his neck. At the end of The Fox with Sandy Dennis and Anne Haywood, a tree falls on Sandy Dennis and kills her. Constant. I mean, even today, there's a film called Kiss of the Spider Woman, and it's a wonderful film. And in fact, the stereotype is used to heighten the dramatic quality of the character, and I think it's a terrific characterization by William Hurt. But he, in effect, commits suicide at the edge of that film by allowing himself to be killed by terrorists and the police. He gets caught in the crossfire on purpose. He sort of gives up his life for an ideal. And it's sort of, in a way, it's depressing because people say, oh, God, as good as these movies are, do we constantly have to put up with homosexual who dies at the end of the movie? And you think to yourself, well, to some extent that's true. And to another extent, there is no movie without dramatic conflict. Nobody wants to make or see a movie about constantly happy people who have no conflict in their lives. Movies are made of conflict. So you have to balance it a little bit. All we're saying in terms of gays is there are as many different kinds of gay people in the world as there are different kinds of heterosexuals. And so what we want to show is the diversity of homosexuality and not simply use the same old tired stereotypes over and over again.
Vito Russo, author of The Celluloid Closet, recorded in 1985. We'll hear from the directors of the new film adaptation of The Celluloid Closet after a break. This is Fresh Air. Before Vito Russo died of AIDS in 1991, he was profiled in the AIDS documentary Common Threads, Stories from the Quilt. The directors of the film, Rob Epstein and Jeffrey Friedman, went on to produce and direct the film adaptation of Russo's book, The Celluloid Closet, Homosexuality in the Movies. Epstein also made the film The Life and Times of Harvey Milk. Vito Russo was the film's publicist. I asked Epstein and Friedman if Vito Russo knew there would be a film version of The Celluloid Closet.
We formally optioned the book soon after Vito's death, and he obviously didn't get to see it realized, but I think he knew he would do it.
I don't think he ever expected it to be as big as it turned out. I mean, he was thinking this would be a PBS documentary with a host narrator, and basically it would duplicate the kind of presentation that Vito used to do when he traveled around with his clip show giving lectures.
Vito used to travel around with these old reels of funky 16mm films and just, you know, throw up a clip and talk, and he did this all over the world.
And we made the decision at a very early stage of the project that this was a film about movies, and we wanted the Celluloid Closet to be a big screen, like Hollywood movie experience. We wanted to get original negative from the studios, and, you know, we've got like a full orchestral score. I mean, we wanted to make the film in the style of a Hollywood movie. And I don't think Vito ever dreamed that The Celluloid Closet would be that.
Your film version of The Celluloid Closet has some really interesting stories about how movies ended up speaking in coded language when they were characters who we were supposed to know were gay, because they couldn't be overtly gay during the days of the Hays Code, because the Hays Code outlawed, quote, sexual perversion.
Right.
And the Hays Office considered homosexuality to come under the category of sexual perversion.
Right.
One of my favorite stories is told by writer Gore Vidal, and this story is about how he wrote the screenplay for the biblical era epic Ben-Hur.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you know, the story here is basically about two friends from youth who now disagree about politics. They're now enemies. One's Jewish, one's Roman. One's played by Charlton Heston, one's played by Stephen Boyd. And he said that this just was not enough of a plot for a three-hour film. I'll let Gore Vidal tell the rest of the story. This is a clip from your film, The Celluloid Closet.
The director of the movie, William Wyler, said, what do you do? And I said, well, look, let me try something. Let's say that these two guys, when they were 15, 16, when they last saw each other, they had been lovers, and now they're meeting again, and the Roman wants to start it up. Masala, played by Stephen Boyd, wants to start it up again with Ben-Hur, played by Charlton Heston, heaven knows why, but he does. Anyway, he's Roman. So, Willie stared at me, face gray. And I said, well, I'll never use the word. There'll be nothing overt. But it'll be perfectly clear that Masala is in love with Ben-Hur. Willie said, Gore, this is Ben-Hur. A Tale of the Christ, I think, is the subtitle, he said, rather vaguely looking around. And Willie finally said, well, it's certainly better than what we've got. We'll try it.
After all these years, still close.
In every way. He said, have you talked to anybody about this? And I said, no. He said, you talk to Boyd, Masala. Don't say anything to Heston, because Chuck will fall apart. I'll take care of him. So Heston thinks he's doing Francis X. Bushman in a silent version. His head is always constantly on high like this and like this. And Stephen Boyd is acting it. Two pieces. There are looks that he gives him that are just so clear.
I said I'd come back. I never thought you would. I'm so glad.
If we were actually seeing the clips that you show mm-hmm. in your movie, the scenes that Gore Vidal is describing with the looks that Stephen, those longing stares that Stephen Boyd is giving at Charlton Heston, what would we be seeing?
Well, you'd be seeing just that. I mean, you'd be seeing Charlton Heston and Stephen Boyd staring into each other's eyes and smiling and giggling. And, you know, it's one of those scenes where, you know, I showed this scene to my brother, you know, who's straight. And he was, he told me that when he saw this movie when he was a teenager or something. And there was something about that scene that always bothered him. There was something that stuck. He knew something was going on, but he couldn't articulate what it was. So I think that's something that happens with this film by taking these clips and putting them in this context. It just lets, you know, it allows you to look at scenes that you may be very familiar with in a different way.
Did you ever ask Charlton Heston if he ever found out that he was the guy who didn't know about the gay subtext?
We haven't, but other people have. He knows about this story, and he's not buying it.
Oh, really?
Oh, he's still not buying it.
No. He says he denies it?
He denies it. He says Gore Vidal is a liar.
We seem to have an ongoing interaction with Charlton Heston. He also sent us a letter denying us the use to a clip, The Agony and the Ecstasy, because he claimed that Michelangelo was not homosexual.
And he knew.
And he knew.
Because he did the research.
Did you watch any films for your movie, The Celluloid Closet, that look completely different to you now than they did the first time you saw them, where you saw a certain gay subtext or where a gay character had a different meaning to you than the first time around when you saw it?
Well, I guess Boys in the Band is a movie that's really changed with time. I think when I saw that movie when it came out, I was just coming out, and I think it made me very uncomfortable. It really seemed like a big downer. I mean, it did not look like this was going to be fun, and I mean, that movie does not look like gay life is much fun. But looking at it 20 years later and putting it in a historical context, you know, this is a reflection of what it was like for gay men coming of age in the 50s. And Vito himself changed his take on that film. I mean, he was out in the street picketing when that film came out. And by the time I saw Vito's presentation in 1981, he was, you know, he had revised his opinion of it and acknowledged that you know, that this was a film that was telling the truth for that time. And, you know, I mean, that's something that's that makes it very hard to know how to look at films that are coming out today. You know, there are films like, I mean, when Philadelphia came out, there was a huge hue and cry in the gay community because there was so little affection between the Tom Hanks character and the Antonio Banderas character. And I was disappointed that there wasn't more of a relationship in that film between those two. And I think that, you know, the fact that we were so upset about that maybe blinded us to some of the positive qualities of that film. I mean, the fact that it really was a breakthrough film for gay people, even though it wasn't, you know, it wasn't the be-all and end-all, and it's not, you know, where we hope to be someday.
Well, it's also a film that's more for our parents, I think, than for gay people, and that's how it was a breakthrough, the fact that it played shopping malls and it reached all those people and said something about our experience.
And had a major star playing a gay character in a very ordinary, sympathetic way.
Right. So in Hollywood terms, it was a big success.
Vito Russo's book, The Celluloid Closet, came out in the early 80s. There was a new edition that came out in 1987. This is 9 years after that. Do you think that the situation has changed in Hollywood since 1987 in the way that gays are shown on screen?
I think it's on the brink of change. Hollywood, like society, is accepting the fact that we exist. And I think a large part of Vito's thesis was trying to prove our existence. We're beyond that now. What isn't happening in Hollywood is more realistic portrayals of gay life. And that's going to happen from gay and lesbian filmmakers. You know, the cameras are now in the hands of gay directors, and that's where the real truth of our lives will come from. And hopefully Hollywood will follow that lead.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us about your new movie. Thank you.
It's a pleasure. Thanks.
Thank you.
Rob Epstein and Jeffrey Friedman are the directors and producers of the new documentary, The Celluloid Closet. It's already opened in several cities, including New York, L.A., and San Francisco, and will open in more cities in the next few weeks. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, a newly rediscovered film from 1965, Who Killed Teddy Bear, starring Sal Mineo as a voyeur. This taboo-breaking film was just re-released. We'll talk with the director, Joseph Cates. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Anthony Davis's reissued album, Episteme. We're listening to it now. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A low-budget exploitation film from 1965, starring Sal Mineo, has just been re-released and may be on the verge of achieving cult status. The film, Who Killed Teddy Bear, was described in one recent press release as a smorgasbord of Hollywood taboos: voyeurism, pornography, masturbation, incest, child abuse, transvestism, lesbianism, and the most explicit rape sequence yet filmed. So it's quite surprising to learn that the director, Joseph Cates, is well known in the TV industry for producing family fare, including hundreds of circus programs, the Emmy Awards, the Tony Awards, and the Magic of David Copperfield specials. And he produced the annual Command Performance Salute to the President. Early in his career, Cates directed The $64,000 Question. Even though his work predated the quiz show scandal by several years, when the scandal broke, he couldn't get work in TV. So Cates took a brief sidetrack into making cheap, quickie films. Who Killed Teddy Bear stars Juliette Prowse as a DJ in a discotheque who gets anonymous sexual phone calls by a man whose fantasy life is built around her. The caller is played by Sal Mineo.
Hello. Look, I know there's someone there, and it's 6 o'clock in the morning.
I know you don't know me, but I know you very well.
Who is this?
I know what you look like right now. I can see your skin. You have the most beautiful, smooth, hard skin.
Look, is this your idea of a joke?
I'm very warm. I could feel your hands touching me all over.
I don't have to listen to that. Go sober up.
Juliette Prowse is alone and afraid. Soon a cop is on the case, but this cop makes Prowse uneasy because he's so obviously obsessed with investigating sex crimes. The cop is played by Jan Murray, who you may remember as a comic and game show host.
Well, we were discussing the telephone psychotic, which is generic, like saying animal. It's a beginning, period. And you start to break it down. Lion, giraffe, mouse.
That was no mouse that called me.
Some are fetishists, some are sadists, some are masochists. Then there are the simple voyeurs, the pedophiliacs. But even that's too neat, too much like rules. So we have the combinations. And I'm not talking about your Uncle Charlie who buys pinup calendars. I mean the complicated pairings. The sadomasochists, the voyeur masochists, the exhibitionists, the necrophiliacs.
You seem to know a lot about these things.
Someone should.
There was no Hollywood code anymore when you made your movie, but there are still things that one didn't show on screen. And you violated what were still then some taboo things in Hollywood. For example, we see what we clearly understand to be Sal Mineo masturbating. We don't actually see him touching his private parts, but we see him in jockey shorts, you know, in briefs, just kind of touching his thigh in a very suggestive way. Tell me how you decided to handle that.
Well, you know, it's more as a craftsman. We didn't set about and say to ourselves, gee, let's connive to do these things that are tasteless in the movie. There was a story, and we had to figure out a way to do it. And I had a very artistic director of photography, a man named Joe Brunn, who was also a painter. And I would discuss these matters with him, and how to communicate. Well, it was very obvious. It was perfectly legal, if you will, to put the actor in tights. He had a splendid physique. And if he wanted to stroke his arm or stroke his stomach or stroke his thigh, and we shot it in a manner that would communicate the idea that he was a pervert. Well, what was wrong with that? It was a craftsman's decision, is what I mean to say.
You said he was wearing tights. Did you mean briefs?
I mean shorts.
Shorts. Yes. Now, was this among the first times that we see a male lead in a movie wearing briefs instead of boxer shorts?
That I can't answer. You'd have to ask a film historian. Incidentally, he wore those briefs because that's what Salminio wore normally.
Another taboo I have to ask you about. There's a rape scene in the movie, and you don't see anybody naked in it. You know, you don't see anything explicit. But I think in terms of the reactions on Juliet Prowse's face, it's actually very explicit for its time. And
well, you know, you're quite right. You don't see anyone opening the pants.
Mm-hmm.
You don't see the skirt going up. As a matter of fact, it's a rather awkward moment when it's ended, when everyone stands up and, you know, they look fully dressed. So it was designed to play it off of the face. I mean, that it was directed that way so that you would understand clearly what was taking place. And yet, if you read it in the script, is it censorable? I don't think so.
Now, I'm interested in your casting of Salminio. I think he had a hard time in his career getting roles as an adult after his successes in Rebel Without a Cause and in Exodus, in which he was still playing teenagers. Was it hard to get him? Was he interested in doing a film that cast him as a sexual pervert?
Salminio was an actor, and he thought it would be a very good role. And you're quite right. He had difficulty getting roles. He certainly had difficulty getting roles.
May we say here that I think part of the difficulty was that he was rumored to be gay, and I think that hurt his career, too.
Well, probably that's so. I don't think it hurt his career because there were others who were rumored to be gay. I just think he was difficult to cast as an adult. He probably would have made a better villain than a leading man or a hero.
What was difficult about him?
Just his appearance, his voice, his sense. He can be an engaging young man. You see that in one or two places in the film. But he's not a classic leading man. So what do you cast him as when he's an adult?
Mm-hmm. So how did he feel about the role?
He was a professional.
Uh-huh.
He was getting paid for it. So he's very much interested in how to do it properly. And he contributed very much in many different ways. Those were natural gestures of his that you referred to. He wasn't directed to stroke himself. When he went into rehearsal, he fell into that natural gesture. We just placed the camera to record it.
Mm-hmm. Now, he makes some obscene phone calls to the Juliet Prowse character because he's just absolutely obsessed with her sexually. What were your language constraints?
Well, remember, you really didn't hear very much of what he said.
Right.
The little that you did hear was just that he thought about her a lot, and he had her in his mind, and he wanted to be with her, and that kind of, you know, bland, suggestive language, if you will.
Now, the Salminio character reads a lot of pornography, and there are shots in Who Killed Teddy Bear of magazines, and we see magazine covers with pictures of women with bare breasts. Now, I think you couldn't have actually shown bare-breasted women in a movie, but I guess you could show the picture of it.
Well, first of all,
yeah,
those are exterior scenes in New York. They were all stolen. There were no permits or anything set up. There were no 15 trucks parked on a street. We went out in a car. The car had a driver and had the director of photography in his camera. It had Salminio in the back seat, a makeup person, and myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I just walked into that magazine store, gave the guy 10 or 20 bucks, and said, we want to shoot here. It'll take 10 minutes. And so everything you see is real. We didn't place it. We didn't position it, you know, for emphasis.
Mm-hmm.
It's real. And part of it was maybe to suggest in the movie what fed this suggestible psychotic. And what fed him, maybe I was trying to be moral at that point. Because I'm really against that kind of open exhibition of magazines. You saw real window displays, you know. You saw real motion picture marquees, and you saw real magazines, all readily available, all in the window, all open to whomever passes by.
Well, what were the film standards at the time in terms of showing magazines with naked women on the cover?
Well, I think, look, ours was a slightly sleazy film.
I like the way you put that.
I enjoyed the Village Voice review, which started out, "It's crummy." First two words, "It's crummy, but strange, but very stylish, and strangely enough, eminently watchable." I appreciated that. All true.
My guest is Joseph Cates. He directed the 1965 film Who Killed Teddy Bear, starring Sal Mineo. It's just been re-released. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Joseph Cates, he directed the 1965 film Who Killed Teddy Bear, which has just been re-released. Now, I want to get back to the casting. You cast Elaine Stritch in the role of the discotheque owner. And so Elaine Stritch is the character who, she plays the character who employs Juliet Prowse, the object of the Sal Mineo character's sexual fantasies. And he plays a busboy at the club. Now, Elaine Stritch, I'd say, is most famous for her roles in Noel Coward musicals and her subsequent roles after your film in Stephen Sondheim's Company and in, the revival of Showboat that's on Broadway.
Yeah, she's a musical artist.
Yeah, and quite wonderful. I think she's wonderful in your film. Now, she plays a very tough lady, and the implication is that she's probably a lesbian. We don't know for certain, but there's a scene where she seems to be coming on to Juliet Prowse. It's kind of chilly in the house, and she puts on a fur coat and says to Juliet Prowse, "I love soft things. Do you love soft things?" Now, again, the code, which was already gone, had kind of outlawed the depiction of gay and lesbian characters. Had there been many gay or lesbian scenes up to that point?
I suppose that any gay or lesbian theme was kind of buried. It could be suggested in ways, there could be clues in the scene, but it was never overt. And so it is in Who Killed Teddy Bear. It is overt. Juliet Prowse says to her, "Look, if I'm mistaken, I'll apologize later, but please leave." We make very clear, we try to make clear, and how do you do that without being offensive, that she is a lesbian. But it's still unclear enough for Juliet to say, if I'm wrong, leave. The putting on of the coat was simply a plot device so that when she left wearing the coat, Sal Mineo would think that was Juliet Prowse and
because
it's
Juliet Prowse's coat, so it's one of these mistaken identity things.
Yes, very, very weak, very implausible.
You cast Jan Murray as a cop who's obsessed with solving sex crimes. Now, Jan Murray was a Borscht Belt comic, a game show host. He hosted, like, all the game shows. What made you think of him as this kind of hard-boiled cop? He's actually quite good in the role. I've never seen him in anything like that.
I do good casting. Interesting casting. Well, first of all, I was very friendly with Jan Murray. And Jan Murray, who was then, doing the quiz show and very successful at it, was studying acting with Wynn Hanman. He was studying dramatic acting. And we would have dinner and he would tell me about it. Now, when I cast Mineo and Prowse first and then I got Lane Stritch, I had absolutely no money after Mineo and Strauss to spend for casting, and I needed a leading man to play a detective in New York, right? An ethnic detective is interesting. And I always saw in Jan a kind of a rugged look. He's believable as a cop.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a voice, and he he's got a rugged physique, and he was willing to work for scale.
Most importantly, right?
For 4 weeks. And he was rather, and also he was kind of a name. He added, a little substance to it.
Yeah, whoever expected Jan Murray and Sal Mineo to be in the same movie?
Well, it's a question of opportunity. Jan Murray, given the opportunity and the parts to grow, would have been a very effective actor, a very successful actor.
Now, Dan Travanti, formerly of Hill Street Blues, has a small part as a deaf bouncer.
We made him deaf because we couldn't afford in the budget to have him speak.
Why not?
Because I'd run out of money. You know, you have to understand something. I wasn't just the director. I was the producer, and I had guaranteed the budget. And I didn't buy completion insurance or anything of that sort. And I wasn't out to lose whatever money I had. So the budget was very strict. And when it came to casting the part, we just figured, make him a deaf mute. It's not only interesting, but it limits the amount of money we have to pay him. It was his first role.
Oh, you mean because you paid him less because he didn't have speaking lines?
Correct.
Oh, I thought you were saving money on the microphone. I see.
No. Also, he was just out of school, and he was very happy to get his first job.
Right, he even spelled his name differently back in 1965.
Oh, did he? I didn't notice that.
Yeah, I think it had a Y at the end instead of an I.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Well, that was the magic change for him, wasn't it? A Y to an I, and lo and behold, a television star.
So, how did Who Killed Teddy Bear get re-released?
You know, I know backwards. My son lives in California. And one day he called me up. He said, Dad, you're not going to believe this. I found a flyer which says that there's the midnight screening of a cult movie. And it's Who Killed Teddy Bear. So I said, well, why don't you go and see? So he went to see it, and he met the man from Strand Releasing, who said, you know, I found a print of this film. We don't know who owns it. So my son called me, and I told him who to call. It's now owned by Todd A.O., and which is run by a man named Sal Hasnain, who was involved originally at the UA Theater Circuit. And I said, see if he can, you know, make an arrangement with him. See, because they weren't charging for these midnight screenings. They didn't have the rights to it. Strand did indeed make the arrangement, and they're putting it out. And Strand, as I understand, and I'm certainly not being critical, Strand does tend to release films of special appeal to the gay audience. And I hope indeed that they come and see it.
Now, do you think the film is being received differently now than it was in its time?
Yes, I do.
What's the difference?
I think the difference is, I don't know the word for it, but I think the film gives you a window on 1965.
Yes, right. Not only on how the streets of New York looked and what people were wearing, what the music was, but also what the kind of standards of morality was in movies. What was really seen as going too far?
Well, partially that, but I think very much so. The music, the dances, the mm-hmm. way people dressed, the way they looked.
Oh, there's a great scene of a couple frugging.
Yes, and it's real. Those were not dancers.
No, you could tell. Yeah.
So I think that that's kind of a window on that world, the street scenes in particular. I think there's a great... Sal Mineo became kind of a cult figure through the years.
Yes.
So I think that that's of particularly strong appeal. I think his sexual ambiguity, you know, at the time, is now, it's interesting to view years later in performance. So I think there are other things working. Now listen, the picture is not a smash hit. I understand it did fair business. It deserves to do a lot more.
You have, four children?
Yes.
And now they're getting to see the film for the first time. Did they know about it beforehand? Had they seen it before? What's
no,
reaction?
Of course not, because two of them were 2 years old and 3 years old at the time. My son had seen it in California. So I went with my two older daughters to the opening night screening and with my two son-in-laws. And, of course, they had no idea that I had ever been a film director. I mean, vaguely, Daddy, once, you know, in the middle, they think of me as a television producer. So to actually walk in and see on a big screen a film, and particularly a film in this subject matter, was a little startling to them. You got to remember, my reputation was for family entertainment. Eye shows and magic shows and circuses and musical programs and, you know, and pageants. And it was really family entertainment. And then they come in and they see this, you know, it reminded me of I had a brother-in-law. I have a brother-in-law who was once an attorney for Penthouse, and then he became an attorney for Playboy, and his children used to call him Porno Papa. I think my children were impressed. I have one daughter as an actress, you know, Phoebe, and my son-in-law.
Oh, your daughter is Phoebe Cates.
Yes,
oh.
And my son-in-law is Kevin Klein, and I think it was wonderful for them because they never think in terms of me as having any knowledge or experience with film, and I think they were very interested in seeing it. And then my other daughter, Valerie, is a writer, and my other son-in-law is an artist, and they were particularly impressed. I mean, they really found, a surprising merit in it for its time.
For its time,
but
he
you
said.
Know, it's great to amaze your children many years later.
So, is the movie going to come out on video?
Yes. Oh, I look forward to that.
Do you know when?
No, I have no idea.
Okay.
I think they'll start shopping it pretty soon. They'll take the New York reviews, and once they've got it booked around, that'll create some interest in it. It'll just be great for me to send out as a Christmas gift. To a lot of dignified people and say, see, I was a roisterer in my youth.
Well, Joseph Cates, thanks so much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you.
Joseph Cates directed the 1965 film Who Killed Teddy Bear. It's just been re-released. It's already played in New York and will open in more cities in June. This is Fresh Air. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says that back in the early 1980s, it was easy for critics to predict exactly where jazz was going. It would be the decade of innovative composers like Anthony Davis. The real story was a little different. Kevin reviews a reissue of a groundbreaking Davis album from 1981.
From the beginning, jazz has seesawed between periods when either composers or improvisers had the upper hand. Improvisers had ruled after John Coltrane became an idol in the 60s. By 1980, it was time for a visionary composer to come along and design new frameworks for soloists. An odds-on favorite to fill that role was Anthony Davis. His music was innovative and clear and had a sleek surface texture. Like composers as far-flung as Steve Reich and Robert Fripp, Davis was drawn to the shimmering textures and suspended time of Balinese gamelans, orchestras of tuned metal percussion. That's Wayang No. 2 from Anthony Davis's album Episteme. That 1981 recording was recently reissued on CD by Gramavision. Episteme was also the name of Davis's nine-piece band, including George Lewis on trombone, Warren Smith and Jay Hogard on mallets, and Faronok Loff on drums. In a way, their music sounds like improvised variations on Steve Reich's quilted patterns. For decades, jazz musicians had played in recognizable classical styles. The Modern Jazz Quartet improvised mock Baroque counterpoint, for example, but contemporary classical music had been harder to work with. A few people wrote blues tunes in Schoenberg's 12-tone idiom, although as far as I know, no one wrote a good one. But the minimalism of Reich and Terry Riley, with its short repeater riffs, was an easy stretch for anyone grounded in African-American music. Davis himself once said that there would be no minimalism without rhythm and blues. On these recordings, you can hear the band grappling with the new concept. Episteme's next album, Hemispheres, had a tighter weave. That's also on CD, by the way. The band's style and one or two specific themes came back in Davis's 1986 opera, X, The Life and Times of Malcolm X. But back in the early 80s, Episteme didn't make Anthony Davis the next big thing after all. Instead, something else happened nobody had predicted. The 50s came back, and the stars of jazz were wearing suits, playing like old Miles Davis records, and denouncing unorthodox African-American music like Anthony Davis's. So, the critics were wrong, and some good ideas were left hanging in the air. But every art form values inspired mavericks as well as matinee idols. That's why we treasure Hieronymus Bosch and Lawrence Stern as well as Rembrandt and Dickens, and Pee-wee Russell as well as Benny Goodman, and Anthony Davis, as well as that other riffing minimalist, Count Basie.
Kevin Whitehead is currently in Amsterdam researching a new book on Dutch jazz. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet, with Alan Tu and Kathy Wolf. Research assistance from Rena Bander. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.